Well, you know, I think that over the last 2 years, you know, leading up to the 2016 presidential election, we've seen a surprising turn in America. And I think a lot of us have thought that a lot of the battles against prejudice and against hatred and against injustice, not that everything was perfect and that there are lots of things that still needed to happen, but that sort of the wind was at our back, and that, you know, Martin Luther King's The Arc of History was, you know, moving towards justice. And I think a lot of us have been pretty appalled at what we've seen happening in Washington with our politicians and with the kind of racism and hatred that's emerged. And maybe it's always been there. Maybe now with our president, it's been emboldened and allowed to emerge. But in any case, I thought it would be useful to remind people how recent some of this progress is, how fragile it is, and maybe wake people up from a slumber that I think a lot of people, myself included, have been living under, thinking it's just really somebody else's problem to solve, and the problems are not as bad as they were, and don't worry, those politicians will take care of it. And I think there's been a general sense the last year to 2 years that that each of us needs to figure out where we stand on these issues and actually personally get involved. The Good Fight Project, the Good Fight, America's ongoing struggle for justice, actually started at a conversation I had at the TED conference about 2 years ago with a gentleman named Jonathan Greenblatt, who's the new director of the Anti-Defamation League. And we were just talking about a lot of these issues, a lot of things that the Anti-Defamation League fights against. And he just said, has anybody ever done a book which actually looked at how inspiring all these struggles are across this whole wide range of, you know, African-Americans and Jewish-Americans, Muslim-Americans, Latino-Americans, the gay community, women, the disabled, Native Americans. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Well, I think there have been books about, or people that have focused on each of these groups, but I don't think anybody had ever sort of tried to do an overview. So it was through their, you know, generous, you know, support, we spent almost 2 years meeting with photographers, going through archives, finding writers, and trying to figure out how to weave these stories together.
So you have it organized, you know, starting Native Americans, African-American struggles, the struggles of each of these groups. When you look at the overall picture, what do you take away from it? What did you learn from putting this book together?
I was kind of worried at the beginning that it would be a really depressing book. I was thinking, you know, if you look back at, look, every country's had dark chapters in the past, and hopefully, you know, countries learn from their mistakes, just like human beings, right? We make mistakes in life, and hopefully if we touch our finger to the stove and it burns, we don't do that again. I think that sometimes there's been a tendency, particularly in America, to hide the past, either out of shame, embarrassment, not wanting to own up to it, whatever. And so my real concern when we started working on The Good Fight is that the book would be sad and disturbing, and things that people, it would be so horrific nobody would want to look at it. And what I was really surprised at was how often it came down to individuals who, at the height of their career, or because of their fame, or because of their visibility, instead of sort of burnishing their own career, they actually risk their career. People like Tim Cook, for example, who's, you know, obviously the head of one of the most, you know, valuable companies on earth. You know, Tim didn't need to come out and tell the world he was gay. You know, people like, you know, Martin Luther King, like Shonda Rhimes, you know, who's using her, I think she's the Norman Lear of today. You know, she's got so many different shows on TV that talk about so many of these issues. And Norman Lear, of course, with All in the Family and the Jeffersons and so many of the topics that were discussed, is using humor and drama on TV to remind people that most people are good. Most people are worrying about their children, about feeding their families, about doing something that makes them feel good about themselves. My great pleasure in terms of how people have responded to The Good Fight is that people see it as a hopeful book where it doesn't shy away from the dark history and the tragic past and the mistakes that have been made in America. But also, I mean, here's an interesting question. If you talk to people, any one of the groups that we focus on in the book, and you say, would you rather be in 1917 or 2017, if you're black or Jewish or Muslim or gay or a woman or disabled or Latino or Native American, then when you pose the question that way, everybody says, oh, definitely 2017, which does not at all mean that things are perfect or good or fantastic today, but we've made a lot of progress over the last 100 years, and I think that's one of the things that surprises people so much is, you know, that until 1972 in the United States, there were states that had something called ugly laws, and that if you were disabled and your physical appearance made somebody else uncomfortable in public, you could be fined or arrested. That women couldn't get credit cards without a father or a brother or a male signing until 1972. That the mailing of postcards showing lynchings was illegal as of 1918, but that the lynchings continued until 1948. I mean, things like that where you just go, how is that possible that all this could be so recent? And again, it's a reminder of how fragile all this is. And I think, again, with what's been happening, you know, in our country the last, you know, year, especially since, you know, President Trump was elected, with the you know, the outpouring of hatred and prejudice and you know, pitting groups against each other, I just thought it would be really good to just go up to 30,000 feet and look back 100 years and say, is this really the direction we want to be going in right now?
So why did you focus on the specific groups that you focused on? Were there any groups that you felt afterwards you wished you had included in this book?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, you could, at one point somebody was saying, well, what about the Vietnamese Americans who came over, you know, after the Vietnam War? And what about Asian Americans? And, you know, part of doing a project like this is like, which of your children make it into the lifeboat? Because, I mean, if we had, as it was, we actually added 34 more pages to the book than we had budget for just because we couldn't stand to leave stories and images out. We just kept making the book bigger and bigger and lowering the price more and more. What I can't believe is that Amazon's selling the book for $22. It should be a $70 book. I mean, I'm delighted. But, so, sure. I mean, I'm sure there's groups that... as it is, how do you tell, even with 25 pages or so devoted to each group, it felt like we were skimming a stone across the surface of the lake and barely touching it. One of the things that I think people have really enjoyed about the book, and one of the reasons it's become such a bestseller, is that we have this really interesting technology woven into the book so that you can point your smartphone. There's an app you can download called the Good Fight Viewer. It's available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And you can point your phone at 63 different pictures in the book, and it will launch a TED Talk or a YouTube video or a part of a documentary. So it dramatically expands each story, and it's not necessarily about the picture that triggers it, but it actually gives you, the viewer, the reader, a great, much greater insight into those stories. So in addition to 180 pictures and 258 pages, there's 3.5 hours of video that's triggered by the pictures in the book. So it's kind of a delightful merging of the 600-year-old, you know, medium of the book with the internet, and people seem to really love that.
So here, we are located in the Southwest, and we straddle the U.S.-American border. And that border was one of the major platforms on which President Donald Trump ran. For those living on the border, what is the importance of knowing the history of discrimination against Latino Americans?
Well, you know, every group of human beings has good members of that group and bad members of that group. And one of the things I think America has always prided itself on, not always, but for the most part, is that we're a nation of immigrants, that almost everybody that's here, their parents or their grandparents, their great-grandparents came here because looking for a better life or opportunity. America's always been that beacon in the world. I think President Reagan said it's the only country that was created on a concept rather than a race. So to, you know, denigrate and castigate groups of people coming, many of whom are escaping violence and poverty and oppression from other countries, whether it's from Latin America or drug cartels in Mexico. My understanding is that actually in many border towns, the Latino community has been actually pretty well integrated, and that there's a lot of acceptance, compassion. It's part of the culture. And then I feel like a lot of what's been happening is what we saw with other politicians around the world that are creating a crisis where there isn't a crisis, or exaggerating things and pitting people against each other as a distraction. You live there, I don't, so you can probably speak better to that than I can. But you know, we tried to talk about the incredible history and contributions of people from the Latino community in America, either people have immigrated here or first-generation Americans, the DACA community, the importance of immigrants to American culture. And again, we just wanted to remind people that every one of us ended here because we all immigrated, except for Native Americans. So we were trying to make sure that we had those voices represented in the book, and Ray Suarez, who wrote the chapter on Latino Americans, is a great success story in and of himself. He's one of the nation's leading journalists and Talk of the Nation and NPR and PBS. And so we're really honored to have his voice represented in the book.
So final question here, but you yourself obviously are a photographer. When choosing photographs for the book, what were you thinking? Did you include any of your own work? And I noticed a lot of these photos they had gone viral when they were first taken. What were you looking for specifically?
Well, it's interesting. Most of the projects that I've done over the years have actually been where we've created the photography, from scratch. We've sent photographers out, we've come up with assignments for them, we've sent them out and said, this is what we're looking for, but if you find something more interesting, we'd be delighted, we'd be thrilled if you could surprise us and tell us things that we didn't even know existed. This was one of the few books we've ever done that almost all the imagery in the book was things that we researched and found and sort of wove together this tapestry. I've always said to people that doing the Good Fight book felt like, doing a jigsaw puzzle, but you lost the box, the pieces came in, so you're trying all these pieces together. We looked at hundreds of thousands of pictures. We went through archives in the Library of Congress and Magnum photos and literally the basements of photographers who died years ago and whose families allowed us to go through their contact sheets and negatives. We were trying to make sure the pictures had a good mixture of the past and the present. I do have two pictures in the book. One was taken of Dennis Banks, who was wanted by the FBI. At the time I shot the photograph, he was in front of Mount Rushmore. And I was very lucky that I was the only photographer there at the time when he was wanted by the FBI. It turned out he was being wrongly accused of murdering an FBI agent on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. I shot that when I was like 25 years old for Time magazine. And then there's a second picture I shot last year, the day after Donald Trump was inaugurated at the march here in New York City, of a woman protesting where it says, "Hell hath no fury like 128 million women scorned." I was happy to get pictures in the book, but it wasn't we had a whole team of picture editors from various magazines who helped us choose the best pictures. And the fellow who designed the book, David Griffin, was the former director of photography at National Geographic. So, again, it was really painful what we left out. We looked through hundreds of thousands of pictures to come up with 128 in the book. And there's still ones that are burned into my brain that we simply did not have room for some of them. We wanted to make sure they were big and bold and lots of double-page spreads. I grew up loving Life magazine when I was a kid. And to me, if the highest compliment to me would be if someone said this book feels like a 258-page issue of Life magazine, because that was what I dreamt about when I was a kid as a young photographer just getting started.
All right. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us. We've been speaking with Rick Smolin.